Welcome to This Human Life with the Philosophical Coach. I'm thrilled to have you tuning in. I'm your host, Sam Kilkathus, aka the Philosophical Coach, philosopher, Hume expert, and high performance coach. This podcast is designed for you to go from being the passenger in your life to the owner of your life. It is designed for you to go beyond who you know yourself to be, really. If that intrigues or excites you, then you are definitely in the right place. The ideas are drawn from neuroscience, philosophy, my coaching practice, working with elite leaders, and experience. You can expect candor, humor, vulnerability, and ideas which are unfamiliar to you, and some you may just plain disagree with. You'll also get the opportunity to hear from inspiring coaches and leaders. Now let's get ready to question what we know and go beyond our limitations. Today, I'm peeling back how we understand mental health and the dangers that can have on people's mental health. And to help me do this, I have my guest, Jay Schiffman, who you'll quickly see as an open book. Jay is a vulnerable storyteller and a stigma-destroying speaker, podcaster, and event host. Jay's story of struggle is familiar to the millions of people the world over who also struggle with issues of mental health, substance misuse, and addiction. He's a survivor of suicide attempts and an overdose, and is now in long-term recovery. And it's Jay's mission to encourage difficult conversations and honest education concerning these and similar struggles. He founded his company, Choose Your Struggle, in 2015 with two distinct goals: ending stigma and ensuring that those who struggle receive the help they deserve. He's a fervent believer in radical honesty and the simple fact that neither struggle nor recovery should be treated as a one-size-fits-all experience. And he uses his voice and his platforms to educate, entertain, and empower. So Jay, thank you so much for coming on. And can you tell my audience just a little bit of who you are briefly?
Well, thank you so much for having me. You know, as you said, I like to think of myself as a storyteller, a speaker, and an event and podcast host. But I think the most appropriate way to introduce myself for this conversation is I am a guy in long-term recovery. And what that means, we'll kind of get into here in a little bit.
Beautiful. So you have this company, Choose Your Struggle. So I'd love to know a bit more, like, what does that actually represent?
Yeah. So Choose Your Struggle is my brand. It's my hashtag. It's on all my merch. I mean, it is the mantra that I live by. And Choose Your Struggle was born on the night I first told my story, which was in November 2015. At its base, what it means is this acknowledgement that I'm a guy who was born into immense privilege. I come from means here in the United States, which is a wealthy country. I am a white male. There's so many things about my life that give me a lift. And what that means, one of the things that means, is that I was born into this environment where I got to wake up every day and choose what I was going to struggle for. And by that, I mean, I never had to worry about where my next meal was coming from. I never had to worry about if the roof was going to be over my head when I went to sleep that night. I got to choose what was my struggle going to be that day. But when I found myself struggling with substance misuse and eventually addiction in my mental health, I had lost that ability to choose. My struggles every day were to avoid withdrawal, which, if anyone's listening that's ever experienced addiction, it's just awful. I mean, there is no way other way to put that. Going through withdrawal is just a terrible, terrible feeling. And getting off the couch and actually being a person for the day, those were my struggles. And so when I got into recovery, when I rebuilt my health, I realized what I had regained was the ability to choose my struggles again. And so that's sort of where this comes from. I work with people to help them realize that, you know, even though I was born in this immense privilege, everybody at some at least granular level has the ability to choose something in their life, something they're going to struggle for. And then there are those like me with immense privilege that have the utmost choice of what we're going to struggle for. So for me, those struggles are helping to end stigma and promoting honest and fact-based education around mental health, substance misuse and recovery, and drug use and policy.
I love that. Yeah, I didn't even imagine that's what it was going to be about, to be honest. I was like, choose a struggle. Like, what are you struggling with today in life, sort of thing? No, like, you're like, it's kind of like, what are you fighting for? Like, what do you stand for? It sounds like to me.
Exactly right. Yes.
Yeah, I love that. That's amazing. And I want to take you back. And I want to look specifically at what things were looking like. I think it was in 2009. when you basically attempted suicide twice.
Yep. Yeah, I love talking about this because I don't actually have to go back there. You know, if somebody offered me a chance, no, I'm good. I have no interest in actually going back to that period. So very quickly to kind of get us there, I was born in 1986, and I was diagnosed with ADHD in 1996, 1997, somewhere in there. And to put this really briefly in context, when I was born, the number of people in the United States treated for ADHD was roughly 350,000 young people, maybe a little closer to 400,000. By the time I was diagnosed in the late 90s, that number had jumped to 2 million. So this was exploding around me. And now, unfortunately, we know this now. I personally think they knew this then. But if you put young people who are going through puberty and their brains are changing rapidly and their bodies are changing rapidly, and we all remember how incredibly fun puberty is, and they're already are struggling. I've dealt with depression, anxiety a lot of my life. I have OCD, and these are things I manage. It's okay. It's not a big deal. But you put all of this in a sort of a blender, and what you get is a perfect storm. I was a young kid who really needed some love and some help. And instead, what I got was a diagnosis, and that diagnosis was bipolar disorder. So my therapist starts treating me for that as a late teen. By my early 20s, 21 or so, I am struggling with misuse. And that is, I'm taking more pills than I'm supposed to be taking. I have been taught essentially since I was young that the answer to any time I'm not feeling good, I'm not happy, is to take a handful of pills. And by the time I'm 23, in 2009, I am, if you've ever seen the show House, big Hugh Laurie fan, big House fan, the way he was with his Vicodin, that was me with Klonopin. I was just popping him by the handful multiple times a day. And this was doing terrible things to my body. I was not healthy. But more importantly, this label was doing terrible things to my self-image. I had been told now for over half a decade that I had bipolar disorder, which is a very serious issue of mental health. And I had never gotten a second opinion, as most people don't when they're given a serious issue of a mental health diagnosis like that. And so I internalized, well, number one, I have this thing. As my dad loves to kid me about, I was so convinced of this that I was ready to get the words bipolar tattooed on my arm. I was so sure that I had this diagnosis. And by the way, I have multiple. This would not have been my first tattoo, but it still says something about how serious I thought this was. Yeah. And number two, there's medication that's making other people better, but it's not making me better. And so because I was so convinced, I had such strong blinders on that I had this diagnosis, I trusted my therapist, my family went to him for literally decades. If he said I had this, and he's infallible in my mind, in my family's mind, and I'm not getting better with drugs that are supposed to work for everybody. Well, the problem isn't the drugs. It's not the therapist. It's me. I'm the common denominator there. So summer of 2009, I'm on the road. I'm following a band around the country. Incredible time. I'm living out of my car. I'm going to music festivals every weekend. Loving it. And what was so amazing about that experience for me is more than anything, it was the connectedness. I felt accepted because there isn't a person at a music festival like that that isn't at least open to alternative lifestyles, that isn't at least open to doing drugs and being on a lot of drugs. In fact, in the grand scheme of things, I was not struggling for a lot of these people. You know, there were a lot of people that were taking way more drugs than I was. And remember, my dealer was CVS. My dealer was Walgreens. So while I was taking other drugs too, those were my biggest, was my prescription pills. So I get back from this incredible summer and I return to life and I'm sort of reminded, okay, you don't fit in here. You know where you fit in. That's not sustainable. You can't live your life on the road following bands around. You don't fit in here. You have a really serious issue of mental health that not only is not getting better, but is getting worse. You've alienated a lot of people in your life. Clearly, there's no hope. And I believed the little voice in my head that was telling me that. And so two successive nights, I attempted to kill myself through overdose. The first night I was stopped. The second night I tried again, and this time I took the drugs before I told anybody so they couldn't stop me. And I did succeed in sending myself into overdose. Now, unfortunately, this was 2009 in the United States. And while I would love to say things have changed drastically, that they really haven't, but it was even worse back then. And who showed up at my door but a policeman who put me in handcuffs and led me out of my house and in the process slammed me against the side of his car. That's literally my last image of the night, was me bouncing off the side of his cop car. He treated me like he knew how to do what he was taught to do. I was a criminal in his eyes. And he throws me in the backseat of his car. And I then go into full overdose. I black out. I have brief snippets of memory of that night being handcuffed to a bed at a hospital while they treated me. And I made it. Clearly, here I am. But the next memory I have is sort of like something from a movie where reality, or sort of consciousness, I think is a better way to put that, rushed back into focus.
Yeah.
And I looked around and I was in scrubs and I was in the intake office of a lockdown unit. And I literally looked around and I said, where the hell, different word, am I? I did not expect to live. Clearly. And here I was still alive. I had no idea where I was. And so I spent 3 weeks in that lockdown unit. And then I know I'm jumping real quick and we'll probably come back to this, but was discharged to my parents, who then, on the advice of my therapist, sent me to one of, if not the most expensive long-term care facility, what we would have called a mental institution 50 years ago, here in the United States. And I spent 3 months there. And it was there that I finally realized, okay, maybe this diagnosis doesn't fit me. And I realized that by meeting other people who did have bipolar disorder and sort of being taken aback by how not familiar their experience was to me. But I also met people who were struggling with drug addiction, really incredible, incredible human beings that were suffering with these issues of addiction. And I said, wait a minute, that I recognize, that looks familiar. And I asked my therapist to let me get off the medication and try living without substances in my body. He said no. He said the only way he would let me get off my medication is if the goal was to restart with new medication immediately. And I said, not interested in doing that. I want to know who I am as a person without these drugs.
Mm.
He said no. And what's so crazy, amazing about this is I actually requested and had to fight for it, but I got my records from this facility. And it's incredible to read in his notes the day that I come in and tell him my idea. And he says in there that while he isn't 100% sure that I have what I've been told I have, he says it in there. There is complete confusion. He's not willing to let me try this. And so I, obviously making a very long story short, I ended up discharging myself, went to live with my grandmother and grandfather in the West here in the States, and went through what's called step down detox, which is the opposite of cold turkey, where you take a little bit, you know, less every day. That took me almost 4 months. But in the spring of 2010, I finally had nothing in my system for the first time since I was 11. And that's the day I restarted my life and started rebuilding my health and committed myself to getting healthy and figuring out who I was without these medications.
It's a really powerful story, Jay.
Thank you.
And yeah, I appreciate the forthrightness of it. And, you know, there are a couple of things which you shared just from the get-go, which I thought, you know, just we need to look at now even, because what was clear from what you were sharing is just the way the labeling had such an impact on who you saw yourself to be, right? Like, you know, to the point where you were thinking of having a tattoo put on your arm saying,
serious label. That is the most you can do in terms of a human being of accepting a label, is literally labeling yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I thought what was really great about what you're sharing was just like the language of it. Like the, I have bipolar, right? Like when I hear like, I have something, it's like, it's a part of me. Mm-hmm. That's how it lives when I hear that word. And I like to look at like, there's the, I have something versus how it occurs. Mm-hmm. Right. So I wonder, and this is just me kind of coming up the bat, it's like, I wonder if people were to question these diagnoses and to just even just bring language into it, like where you move from like someone says, you have this, and you go, I have this. You take on what they say as the truth. I have this. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, no, there's also another opportunity to look at it. Like there's an alternative way of looking at this reality. This is how it occurs to this person. And I have a choice of whether this is how it occurs to me. Like if that was provided as an alternative to you in that moment, do you think it would have made a difference?
Well, I think because I was a juvenile when this all started, I think that would have, I am not the best example because everybody around me was sort of confirming this.
Yeah.
As I said, my family, like my brothers all went to the same therapist. My family trusted him implicitly. I will say, however, there is proof to what you're saying. There is a big movement right now, mostly in the United States, but it's spreading. And I love this. And I consider myself part of this, that is seeing a lot of what is taught in AA. There's a lot of it that's great, and there's a lot that's very harmful. And the most harmful piece, besides the anonymous piece, which is harmful to sort of humanity, but to the person, is this rule that you have to accept your label. I am an alcoholic. I am powerless. And what is so harmful about that is that that isn't the case for a lot of people who are in AA. You know, perfect example is myself. I was sent to AA when I started to embrace the fact that, you know, when I went to Arizona to go through detox, the therapist I saw there sent me to AA, and there was no reason I should have been there. I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't powerless to, you know, I didn't have to accept a higher power. A therapist had overprescribed me, had committed a criminal act. Mm. And because of that, I was sick. Why was I being told that if I didn't accept my label as an addict and I didn't turn myself over to God, I wouldn't get better? First off, clearly that's not true. I'm still here and I didn't do either of those things. So clearly that didn't happen. But also, I know so many people in recovery who don't fit that. They struggled and they got over it. You know, they are not religious. They're okay. They didn't need to accept a higher power. And so when you examine this desire to force people to accept their label, it sounds kind of dogmatic. It sounds a little, in this case at least, it's a little scary. And yet that is a thing that a lot of people are forced to embrace. So I truly believe that we are seeing in real time people who are trying to shake off that label and are living a healthier lifestyle because of it. Now, to your point though about mental health, this is something you and I talked about before we started recording that I talk about whenever I'm interviewed. There is this weird dichotomy in mental health where, well, actually, let's take a step back and look at physical health for a second. My aunt is currently in remission from cancer, which I'm obviously very thankful for. But when she was fighting this, every step of the way, she got a third, fourth, and fifth opinion. Every surgery or whether or not she was going to get surgery, every treatment, she went to every cancer doctor in her region and got their opinion. Now, that's the way you fight a serious issue of health. You know, you get the best minds to tell you what they think that you should do, and then you weigh your options. And yet, for a vast majority of people who get any sort of label for mental health, one person tells them and they go, well, I guess I have it. You know, that happened to me. Yeah. One person told me I had these things. I went, well, I guess I had it. Now, as an adult, I have taken some of these labels into working with other therapists. And I've said, here are the things I've been told. What do you think? Perfect example. I had a therapist tell me years ago after this traumatic experience that I was dealing with PTSD. I don't think so. I personally do not believe that that's the case. Now, that being said, I have gone to numerous therapists since. One has agreed, two have not. And so that gives me information to work with. If I had just stuck with the person who gave me that label, I could be going down this rabbit hole of, well, this is how I have to act now that I'm dealing with PTSD. Maybe I have it, maybe I don't, but this person says I do, I should act like I have it. Instead, I've taken that diagnosis and I've gone and gotten other opinions and I've gotten other ideas about how I can treat this or how I can live with it. Or if I don't have it, what can I do to make sure that if any of these things that they also we're seeing that gave me that label in the first place, I can deal with in other helpful and healthy ways. So this is so incredibly important to me that we make this the norm, that we do not take one person's opinion, because these labels have serious implications. And not only that, the treatment of them can often be more harmful than the actual thing itself.
Yeah, and yours is a great case in point. And I think what's so powerful about what you were sharing earlier is the way in which it occurred to you as if, because the medicine that you were taking, the pills that you were taking weren't working, and it was working for other people who had this experience of bipolar, you must be the problem. Like, there must be something wrong with you as a human being. So this just doesn't work for you. So I best leave this world, because clearly I'm not meant to be here.
Well, yeah. And even worse, I think, was to sort of to that point, was that I don't want to live like this. That was the thought that really was the nail, the quote unquote nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
Was me saying, if I'm 23, if this is how it's always going to be, because again, nobody tells you that these are things that you can deal with as you grow older, right?
Yeah.
I was in a time of intense struggle. Nobody was saying to me, my therapist was never saying to me, this may only be a short period. You know, he was saying, this is what you have. And if I had known that here I would be 35 and there would be nothing even remotely close to that struggle again in my life, who knows what I'm feeling in that moment? But I can tell you this, it wouldn't be the hopelessness I did feel.
Yeah. Like, I really wonder if our education system is more set up to look at questions around, you know, the experience from early childhood, because, you know, there seems to be invariable aspects of how the human identity gets constructed. And one of them is, at some point in time in your early childhood, you experience there being something wrong. And then you internalize that as there being something wrong with you. So from that moment on, life occurs at different moments. Like, there's something wrong with you. The world is teaching you, or someone is telling you something, and the way it reflects back, or the way you project it, is that there's something wrong with you. And, you know, I'm curious for yourself, like, whether there's something you could see from earlier on which would have created that experience for you.
Oh, sure. I think that I go back. I say this a lot, actually. You know, one of the reasons I got that initial label of ADHD was that I was the kid who was always more interested in making his friends laugh. I didn't pay attention in school. Now, as an adult, do I show some signs of what we would call ADHD? Sure. But at the same time, the reason I was given this diagnosis was that I was a kid. I was a rambunctious kid. I wasn't an asshole. Sorry if I'm not supposed to cuss on this podcast.
No good.
I wasn't, you know, that kid. I wasn't a bully. I was just a kid who liked doing kid things.
Yeah.
And because I was in an education system that does not fit our modern needs and does not prioritize the individual, I was given a label, and the answer was to treat me with medication. Now, I want to put this in context real quick. I got a buddy who a couple years ago, he asked me if we could go out to lunch. This wasn't unusual. He and I had lunch every once in a while. I said, sure. And he said, look, I had an ulterior motive. I had a question for you. He said, my son was recently given this diagnosis. They want to put him on medication. Now, I know your story. I kind of wanted to bounce some things off of you. And we talked about it for a minute. And it turns out his son was basically me. You know, he was having fun at school. He was running around. Here's the sad part. I was doing this as an 11-year-old. His son was given this label for doing these things as a 7-year-old. And they wanted to put him on medication. And I said, look, man, you know, obviously you're the dad. I've never been a parent. I have no idea. I would say, if you can find a school system that would better meet his individual needs, odds are I think he'll be okay. And he took that information, ended up weighing that with other things, and they ended up pulling him out of that school, putting him somewhere else, and he's never the idea of medication has never been brought up again. And so not everybody's that lucky, not everybody's that privileged,
yeah,
as my friend was, and his son clearly is, having a dad who loves him and is dedicated to him. But I think that story sort of illustrates why I gave those figures I gave you early in the show about, you know, 400,000 to 2 million. And I had a woman come up to me after the show and say, I was saying this on stage, and she said, well, at least we're not doing that anymore. And I said, lady, I'm so sorry to be the one to tell you that number is now 4.5 million, just in the US.
Yeah.
So I think that story illustrates why that number is so high, that instead of changing our school system to better meet the needs of an individual in 2021, we're going, no, we're not going to change the school system that's been in place since the early 1900s. We're just going to force the kids to pay attention through medication. So it's sort of going back to what you were saying about early childhood identity in education there. I think the answers are pretty resounding yes.
Yeah, that's really powerful. The idea that you transform the education system, you also would start to see a decrease in this experience of ADHD, because what you have is children who want to be children, and you're trying to make them mini adults from this very early age, and they're not suited to it.
No. I mean, and our education system is just, it's outdated. You know, it is not, especially now that we know, if they had put recess, let's say, you know, second period, third, fourth period, and sixth period, I would never have been diagnosed. I go out and run around with my friends. I come back in and I can pay attention, of course.
Yeah.
But as a kid, I still have a lot of energy. As soon as we're done here, I'm going to go take the dog for a walk, and then I'm going out with friends tonight. I mean, I'm just a guy with a lot of energy. As an adult, that's a thing you love in a friend, right? They're the one, yeah, let's do it, man. Let's go do, you know, some fun stuff. As a kid, that kid's hard to have in your classroom because he wants the most out of life. He wants to be running around. He wants to be laughing with his friends. So if you value that in an individual, and if you say, we love this about you, how can we better fit your needs? You don't have this diagnosis. Maybe you do as an adult. Maybe you do when I'm really struggling to focus as an adult who can make rational decisions. But as a 10-year-old, as an 11-year-old who can't really make those decisions, something about that doesn't sit right with me.
It also, you know, just the idea of the diagnosis in the first place, it just seems to speak to a backwardness around understanding of like neuroscience and the level of plasticity in the brain. It's like, oh, this is this is who your child is now, and now we need this in order to like fight this disorder.
Yeah. So funny, really funny sort of aside on that. If I was to tell you as an adult, anyone who's listening, that your, let's say, 10-year-old is going to be put on meth, and they were going to have to smoke meth every single morning. Not only would you be like, what the hell is wrong with you? You'd probably come try to get me locked up, right?
Sure.
And yet, meth's sister drug is something you happily put into your kids every single morning. It's called Adderall, and it's being misused on every college campus in America. They are so similar that you can substitute meth for Adderall. It's that they're that close. Now, it's not recommended. Adderall is a little bit safer of the same chemical compound as meth, but it's the same thing. And yet we think of one of those as this street drug that'll rot your brains. And the other one is, yeah, we'll give it to every kid in America. So yes, that's an oversimplification of a giant issue. But the point I'm trying to make here is if you have trouble wrapping your head around giving your kid meth, but you're cool with Adderall, know that that's because you've been conditioned to think that, and not because they're different drugs. They're pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. And I think the conditioning is a critical aspect of all of this. It's the conditioning around what education has to look like. It's the conditioning around like when we can't figure out how to deal with the child, we will look for a drug or medicine to treat them, because it's like, we don't know what to do. We need some sort of professional opinion. And unfortunately, the professional opinion seems often to say, I'll just give them this, because they don't know either. And they've just been conditioned to kind of go down this pathway. And then the cycle just continues.
We saw proof of exactly what you're saying. You know, I really try to fight back against this term, the opioid crisis. We don't have an opioid crisis. We have an overdose crisis. But people are dying from meth, which is not an opioid. Are you telling me they don't matter? Because I hate that term.
Yeah.
But we did see a flurry starting in roughly 2010 to about 2019 of significantly high use of prescription opioids. And the reason was exactly what you're saying. Now, Are those drugs evil? Of course not. There are people, I was on one. And when I had a back injury, I was okay, actually. I was struggling with so many other things. Did I misuse it? Yeah, because I was struggling with everything at the time, but I was fine. Now, there's nothing wrong with those drugs in safe, controlled settings. They are just drugs. No drug is good or evil. You know, if we're actually looking at harm, the most harmful substances on earth, the three most harmful substances are all legal. And those are alcohol, sugar, and nicotine. So we're not talking about harm, but these drugs, opioids, were misused by so many people because they were lied about. It had nothing to do with the drug itself. These pushers, the Sackler family and others similar like them, told doctors that they're not addictive. And so if you're a doctor and you're told that, you're thinking, awesome, I finally have something that can get rid of pain that's not going to hurt my patient. So I don't blame most doctors. Now, were there some that were doing some really terrible things? Of course there were. But they're bad people in all walks of life. But if those drugs had been correctly labeled from the beginning as, hey, do not overprescribe these, they are addictive, you have to watch them closely like we do a whole host of other drugs, we would not have seen this rise in misuse of prescription opioids. So it's not the drugs themselves. It is, to your point, it is the way that we address them. It is the way that we were taught to use them. Mm. And instead of going to other ideas about trying to treat pain, you know, these drugs were so strong that for something, when I threw out a disc in my back and could barely walk, okay, that's when you get an opioid. But otherwise, we are just taught that we're not supposed to be in any sort of pain, which is ridiculous. I'm 35. If I wake up wrong, I hurt for a week. That's just life. So you have to get used to being in some sort of pain. If you're a doctor who's telling your patients, hey, I can get you out of all pain, okay, there's something wrong with that equation.
That's an interesting one. To wake up and not to experience pain is the kind of like the abnormal kind of condition for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thankful that that's not my own situation at the moment, but I definitely know enough people that is. And you kind of like, yeah, you just be grateful for your health while you have it.
I got a buddy who's a comedian, one of my best friends, and he does a bit on stage about how whenever something hurts, we're at the age now where he wonders, is this just for today or is this how life's going to be going forward? Mm. Because, you know, if he plays a lot of sports, if you fall weird, well, now my elbow is just going to go that direction the rest of my life. So, you know, if that's just something we have to accept as human beings on this planet, and anyone who tells you that your goal should be no pain, they're trying to sell you something.
Yeah, I think the idea of no pain would be also like you're not going to feel certain emotions as a human being. It's almost, that doesn't sound very realistic. Just to experience the plethora, the nuances of the human condition is to experience pain in its different forms. And not all pain is bad.
No,
pain is cathartic.
And pain can be very educational. You know, I mean, the there's that condition, I wish I remembered the name of it, where people physically do not feel pain. And those people usually do not have long lives because they don't learn. They don't learn, oh, I shouldn't do that. You know, that causes me pain. They end up with burns. They end up with terrible things happening to their body because they literally do not learn that this is a thing you shouldn't do.
No, it's a great example of you know, we are very quick to adapt and to see like, okay, this is something we don't want to experience, but we need to experience it first to be able to understand that this is something to take yourself out of situations where it's going to come more commonplace.
Yeah. and some pain is something that, you know, let's be honest, without it, we could not live. You know, if you were hurt from your first breakup in middle school and then decided never to date again because you didn't want to feel that emotional pain, that's not a life worth living. You know, that is a pain that we all accept we're going to get. Rejection and especially the ending of a relationship is intense pain. But without it, you don't get to enjoy the beauty of a good relationship. You know, I'm happily married to my wife, and I'm so thankful for this relationship. But if I had given up with some of these horrible relationships I had when I was younger, I wouldn't be enjoying the beauty of this relationship. So, you know, some pain can be things that we just have to accept and move on as an opportunity for growth.
100%. Yeah, like certainly for my own sake, like, if it wasn't for the pain that I experienced when, you know, I was in the experience of like suicidal ideation because I was just like, there is something deeply wrong with me. Like, I'm intelligent. I'm in these elite institutions as an academic, and yet somehow I just can't get it all together. I can't complete it. I'm in my own way, and I don't know what to do. And I'm too scared to ask for help. And I'm too ashamed of the fact that I can't figure it out. So I'm just looking at like, how do I just leave this world? Because it's like, it's just too much. And it seems to be one of the things we're conditioned to do is find it really difficult to ask for help or to tell people that we're struggling. And it's so great that your hat says fuck stigma, because it's like to break past that. So like to see like vulnerability is your greatest strength, and asking for help is actually a source of essentially transformation. I mean, in my case was really like the pinnacle, and the platform for me to be able to, well, be here in this conversation with you, but to now be a stand for others to have a life which they love. Because I got to see like, oh, like I've just created this view of who I am really, and it's just based on the conditioning that I've experienced. It's based on these bankrupt beliefs which don't serve me. And thankfully I was, you know, I didn't, you know, take a way out, because I'd had experience of suicide with people and, you know, I'd known before, and I'd seen the impact it had, and that was enough. And just thinking about my friends and family was enough to go, okay, I need to look at something else. But it was only because I saw something new and I had someone standing to question what I already believed about who I was really, that I actually got an opportunity to move from the pain to, okay, I can actually empower people to live a life they love. You know, and I get to have conversations like this with you, Jay, which I'm grateful for.
Well, I'm so glad that you had that experience, not the suicidal ideation, although it sounds like it really helped make you who you are, but more the learning that came from that. And I think back to what you're saying reminds me of a really incredible conversation I had with an evolutionary biologist who told me that, you know, there's a reason that our brains remember 100 negatives for every positive. And when you go back to the earliest days of man, this was their explanation. Mm-hmm. If you remembered that the saber-toothed tiger family lived over there, that was more important than knowing the tastiest berries were over here. Because if you went the wrong direction and found that the family of saber-toothed tigers, there's no opportunity to learn from that. You're done. That's it. Okay. Yeah. You're off. But if you forgot where the tastiest berries were, that's okay. You just keep wandering around until you find them. You keep searching. There's no immediate end of life. So our brain started with that need to remember all of the negatives as a priority, because at that time, the negatives meant you're done. There's no more learning. Whereas the positives were not as influential on our early development. Now, of course, fast forward all these years, and that doesn't really serve us anymore. We don't need to remember every time we cross the street, look this way, look this way, look this way. But that's what our brain is doing, because it's still conditioned to make sure that we're remembering all the negatives. And there's a trick on this that I was taught by a therapist years ago.
Yeah.
And I have a course on a website called Listenable, called Mindfulness Beyond Meditation. Very long story short, yeah, I never found the benefit from meditating that other people told me they did. And sure, so I spent years collecting other mindfulness techniques that I've now shared. And I have that course, I teach in person. But one of my favorite tips that I've learned is, and people have riffed off this, but essentially at its base, is keeping a reminder as visibly as possible of positives. Because if you know that every negative is going to be 100 times more weight, given more weight in your brain than every positive, you need a lot of positive to outweigh those negatives. And so I know one coach who does this she teaches her clients to have a box that they keep on their desk full of all the nice things people have said about them, all the awards they've gotten, all that kind of stuff. As I was telling you before we got on here, I used to keep emails taped up right behind where I am looking right now, right behind my camera, of all the positive things people have emailed me, because those were, anytime I would have a little bit of that negative that would come in, I could look up, nope, you know, that's just my brain doing its thing. Here are all the positives. Yeah. And so this is a really helpful tool for people who do struggle with any sort of anxiety, is that sometimes we know where the anxiety is coming from. In fact, I think that if you do enough mindfulness and you work hard enough, you can usually trace that thread back to whatever the little kernel is that's bothering you. And if you, as long as you deal with that, you can wipe out a lot of anxiety. That's not the case for everybody. Some people have what's called general anxiety, and they really cannot figure out where that anxiety is coming from. And so I truly believe that if you have enough reminders of all the positives, you can help tamp this stuff down, because you can keep your brain from reminding you all the time about the negatives by screaming at it with all the positives. And I recommend to everybody that they give that a try.
Well, I think with the point around anxiety, it's one which I'm very passionate around, because I experienced it for myself till I was 31. And I didn't question the idea that I had anxiety. Like, the idea of not experiencing anxiety was just didn't even, it was unfathomable. You know, as an academic, as a philosopher, the way that I understood the world was through my thoughts. So to consider that my thoughts were not me would be, you know, completely, you know, just didn't make any sense. So what I found helpful is, like, you know, a lot of the people talk about in personal development, thoughts create your reality. I think that's bullshit. I think it's not that the thoughts create your reality. It's the significance that you give your thoughts,
yes,
which creates the reality that you live into. So if you're listening to every thought you had, as I used to, as if it's you, then it's going to have a lot of significance no matter what. And you're going to think, oh, I'm a terrible person. Oh my God, like, I've got this idea. Like, well, what should I do? And then it's just this spiral of thoughts. And it's what I call being a deep thinker. There's just this stacking of thoughts. And usually we think of deep thinking as like, oh, I've pondered something for a long time and I've come to some interesting resolution. No, that's just the experience of being a human being, is to think about some subject and then to stack more thoughts about that subject until sometimes it creates a spiral where you're like, I don't know the way out. And then you just have this thought feeling loop, which you're constantly experiencing. And that's what anxiety essentially looks like for a lot of people. And then it can have this physical manifestation as well. It can have the emotional one. And then there's the memory as well, which you're experiencing around it. It's like, and then life just looks like this is always the way it's going to be. So with generalized anxiety disorder, I think there are two things. One is, like, you're saying that with the disorder, there's something wrong because there's a disorder here. There's a kind of chaos to here, like, there's order is the norm. And yet for you, life looks like this. So there's something wrong here. And that goes back to this point of people experiencing life where there's something wrong with them as a kind of fundamental aspect of the way people's identity gets formed. And I think that's the thing we have to fight back against, really, is like the assumption that generalized anxiety disorder is this thing which has a reality beyond the label and the agreement in society that that's what is actually there, is really dangerous, because it allows people to continue to live into a reality where that's just what's so.
Well, I think that one of the points that you've really, I think, hit on without even realizing it is this misconception around another very real but misunderstood condition for a lot of people, myself included, which is called, we call obsessive compulsive disorder. And what's so misunderstood about this is that we always focus on the second half of that, the compulsions. Mm. And everybody knows the ridiculous examples, right? The TV detective monk is a great one. I was a fan of the show Scrubs, and there was a character on there who Michael J. Fox played him, who had OCD. The focus is always on the ridiculous actions that they're doing, while that's sort of as the less important part of this condition. And in reality, the reason you do those things is that your brain is telling you endlessly, to a point where you're having trouble disrupting the thoughts, the obsessive part. That, you know, let's say if the person's washing their hands 100 times a day, it's because their brain is telling them, I am unclean, and if I'm unclean, I'm going to die. If I'm unclean, I'm going to die. And yet we see somebody washing their hands and we go, oh, that's just ridiculous. But one of the things that we're taught when we learn how to deal with having a brain that does this, from, you know, for some people, it's very extreme. And for others like me, it's something that, you know, is kind of a little voice going on in the back of our heads that we can work on ignoring, is not, as you perfectly laid out, not giving validation to every thought in our head. And there's this idea that I think a lot of people struggle with, is that if I think it, I must either be it or I must want to do this. And so people get really afraid when their brain gives them a really scary signal, something like, oh, I don't know, I want to kill my mother, or I want to sleep with, you know, fill in someone that you're not supposed to want to sleep with. And we freak out. Oh my God, I can't believe I thought that. Your thoughts don't mean anything, nothing. You can't control them. You know, we have millions a day. Some of them we don't even realize. They get lodged in our subconscious and they start to grow. And if you don't do some mindfulness, they can turn into pretty scary monsters. But if we give validation to every single one of those thoughts, you are going to develop this idea of who you are, your identity, that is pretty traumatizing. And if you work on, as those of us with OCD are forced to, accepting that our thoughts really don't mean anything, and that we don't have to give weight to every single thought, and that our actions are really what's more important, then you can start to let some of this go, and you can start to decide on what identity you actually want to accept, and not just let these thoughts, which again mean very little, dictate who you are.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said, Jay. Like,
thank you.
I really agree with what you had to share there, and I think it's really great that, you know, the training that you've got from your experience of OCD has allowed you to see the insignificance of your thoughts. I think people's lives in general would be so much more joyous and peaceful if they could take that on more and more. And it's, you know, and it's something that, even though I've done a lot of work, I can still see there are times where I'm taking on my thoughts of me. And so then I have to step back and be like, okay, where am I taking my thoughts too seriously? Where am I taking this as like as a reflection of who I am in this moment? Sometimes it might take a moment to get back. Sometimes it might take a few hours, whatever it is. But it's about like just that. For me, it's like building a muscle where I have that awareness where I'm like, all right, I've got myself right now into a place where this has a significance for me, and I am choosing to take on the identity of all that significance.
Yeah, and I think that the most important part that you just said, to me at least, that I want to underscore, is that taking the time to actually give thought to all of this, right? We are sort of, those of us especially in the business world, are taught that we need decisions now, we got to do this now. And it's like, that's not how our brains work. You know, this is something one of my teammates, my strategist, that I tell him every week, for an hour of billable time, he has to go take a walk. He has to go fishing. He has to do something, because his greatest ideas and his goal is helping me grow this company do not come from sitting while staring at a computer screen. That's not the way our brains work. His greatest ideas, because all of our greatest ideas come when we're doing something for ourselves, when we're taking a deep breath, when we're meditating, if that's what you do, when we're doing yoga, if that's what you do, when we're exercising. That's when our brain goes, great, I can turn off for a minute, and that's when beautiful ideas come. And so I specifically tell him, when we're bouncing ideas off each other, I say, great, now take what I've just given you and go away for a while. Go take a walk, go for a run, you know, do whatever you want to do on billable time, because that's where I know you're going to come up with the best ideas.
I love the idea of taking it on billable time. So it's like, oh, I'm getting paid to do something I'm going to avoid, because I'm like, I don't have the time to do it because I've got to get back to work. It's like, no, this is actually part of the process. Yes. I've experienced this for myself so many times. When I was finishing my PhD, what I would do is I would create like moments throughout the day where I'd just, you know, do some push-ups or some pull-ups or whatever it was, until I'm sort of just in that flow moment. Because for me, the physical exercise is the driver. We're focusing on something else, and inside of that, you're just, as you said, the brain is just like free to kind of create whatever new connections it wants. It's got out of the way all of the fog, which is there, and what's already kind of been percolating comes to the surface. And it's like, oh, I see that really sharply now. I use Otter all the time to transcribe things. So I'll finish doing some exercise, and then I'll start transcribing. Sometimes I was doing it while I was going for a run. I just like, all right, I've got this idea for a podcast. And that's how I literally started doing it.
So let me give you an exercise then that I love doing for all your listeners.
Yeah.
This is one of the ones that I teach, and I think it is the most helpful that I do. It's called the daily check-in, and it's sort of what you're saying, but for your mental health and your subconscious. Mm. It's very easy to start. All you have to do is get a piece of paper, a notebook, a journal, or I use my phone's note app, and I, like you, I dictate it. I don't even write it because then I get caught up with spelling and all, and that doesn't matter. What matters is you write the words or speak the words, I feel, and then you complete the sentence. And when you first start, it's very easy. I feel angry. I feel hungry. I feel annoyed. But then when you start actually practicing this, you eventually start getting deeper and deeper into your conscious, and then eventually your subconscious. And eventually, once you get good at this, what starts to come up will shock you. And again, this goes back to what we were saying before. These things don't have meaning by themselves unless they are things that have meaning. And so I am annoyed that my wife didn't do this. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Let me explore why I'm feeling annoyed about that. Or I'm scared of this. Well, that's never going to happen. I can let that one go. You know. But if you don't know what's going on down there, number one, you're not going to know yourself as truly as you actually can. But number two, like a garden, if you don't get down there and start getting your hands dirty, you're not going to be able to pull up those weeds from the root. You're just going to hack them off at the top. They're going to grow right back. And that's not a healthy way to deal with your mental health. And so I'd always tell my clients, you know, some of these things that come up will scare you. If there's something you actually are worried about, take that to your therapist. I've talked to enough therapists. They want that thing. They don't want you coming in with your everyday BS unless that's really sitting on you. But most of the time, what we bring to our therapist is, I'm mad that my sister said this to me. Well, who cares? Who cares that your sister said this? I mean, like, do you actually need her approval? Probably not. Let's work on getting over her approval. So what you actually get to down there in your subconscious, that's the real things. Those are the things about you that you are truly having trouble with. And that's what your therapist wants to work with you on.
So the question I want to, you know, finish us off with is really looking at, like, what is it about mental health that people are misunderstanding? And what can we do differently?
Well, I would say if you go back to the earliest, you know, mentions of mental health in our sort of knowledge of human history, it's always people who were just different. Now, that's not to say that there aren't very serious struggles that need to be handled with love and treated as you would a physical ailment, right? Perfect example. I have a friend who just flat out refuses to go to a therapist. She went through some really traumatic stuff. She just will not go see a therapist. And I keep telling her, what you went through is if somebody came out of the bushes and just banged your legs like you wouldn't believe. And now you're walking around with your legs backwards and you're like, nah, I won't see a doctor. I'll be fine. What you went through was a very serious traumatic experience. You need to work with someone who can fix your legs for you. It's just a normal part about being alive. I'm sorry you had to go through this. We all go through traumatic experiences. As you've heard, I've now spent over a decade working with people to go through and work on what I went through in my early 20s and late teens. So that's not what I'm about to say. I guess what I'm saying is not to discount that there are very serious issues of our mental health struggles that do need to be worked on with professionals. But this giant label of mental health issues or disorders, whatever, sweeps up a lot of people for whom that's not the case. I have a good friend, very good friend, who is trans, he is autistic, and he has struggled with his mental health for most of his life, not because there was something wrong with him, but because of how society accepted him as a person. You know, he presents as he looks like a female, and yet he has always identified as a male person. He Yep. is autistic, and there's nothing wrong with him. He's a wonderful human being. He's one of my favorite people on this earth. But he has struggled his entire life with some very serious identity, the way that he sees himself and dealing with that because of how the world sees him. And when we talk about mental health, yes, we're talking about those people who have very real diagnosable issues of mental health. That's very real. We're also, unfortunately, talking about my friend who has been given these issues of mental health because he does not fit into our society. And so when you are able to recognize that this mental health, you know, people who struggle with mental health is a very wide spectrum, you start to recognize that treating everybody the same is pretty terrible. And there's a lot wrong with that. And unfortunately, that is sort of our current approach to this. If someone can get any help at all, which is unfortunately too rare, either they are sent into inpatient where they are sort of, and again, I know this from experience, everyone's kind of treated the same, or you work with somebody maybe once a week if you're lucky, but more likely probably once a month, and you never really get to unpack all of these issues. So I would say the number one thing we need to do is just make more help available, make more accepting society. These are huge asks, but you know, if somebody asks me, you know, what do we need? I say that. And I also say, I don't have a lot of hope because progress moves so slowly, but there are little things that makes me feel like we are moving ever so slowly in the right direction.
Well, I think one thing which is promising is the explosion of coaching in the world. And the reason I say that is because I know a lot of people who've done therapy and it hasn't made a difference. And too often therapy has been seen as a solution to fixing a problem. So you're coming from, there's something wrong with, rather than coaching, which is to what, when I'm coaching people, the foundation is there's nothing wrong with you. And you may not believe that when you come to speak to me, but that's what we're going to work on. We're going to work on all these beliefs which you have, which have created this experience that there's something wrong with you. And it doesn't matter if you're a really high achiever in life and you've, you know, you're killing it, or whether things look really bleak. Like, that experience is so invariable. So the more we can destigmatize this idea that there's something that needs to be fixed, right? Like, there's nothing that needs to be fixed. It's right. Not like going to a doctor. You don't have a broken leg which needs to be fixed, right? So if you tell someone, like with your friend, it might even be the case, like when you're giving someone advice, then it's like, okay, this person sees there's something wrong with me. Now I need to fix it. And even if it comes from a good place, it can still land from, oh, this is a validation of how I feel about myself, right? Whereas, you know, I think what's brilliant, at least coaching, is the way in which you're not coming from that place. You're coming from, like, what is the life you want to create for yourself? What is it that, what kind of identity do you want to challenge? What kind of beliefs do you want to give up now, which aren't serving you anymore? If you could, you would. Right? Because lots of people realize they have these limiting beliefs, but they don't think they can actually get rid of them because they think they're part of them. You know, lots of people would love to have no anxiety and they go to a therapist to deal with anxiety, but then they don't believe that they can ever do anything except to have anxiety relief or manage anxiety. And I'm like, no, you can disappear it if you actually understand what the experience looks like, not conceptualizing what it is to have anxiety. That's really easy to do. But you get into the experience, and there's research around this, about what it looks like to unwind anxiety. Judson Brewer has done a lot of research around this. And, you know, I've worked in the last year in an environment where I really got to look at the way we conceptualize things in the world versus actually getting into the experience. And when you get into the experience, you're really able to look authentically, like, what's going on with you internally in terms of your emotional, your physical, your mental, you know, the whole world of that. We usually think of what's going on with us internally or our internal state as our mind, I think most of the time. But there's a whole world which is constructed, where we construct, and it's going on, you know, automatically, but we don't relate to it that way. So the more we can get into the experience, the more you actually have an opportunity to disappear. And I've done this with, you know, I remember doing this with someone who was a really high performer who was dealing with anxiety. I was at work and she said, Sam, you've dealt with anxiety before. And I was just about to take lunch. And I said, yeah, what's going on? She's like, oh, so my throat is seizing up. And I'm like, okay, so are you your throat? She said, no. And then she's like, and then my stomach is constricting and I feel really tight here in the chest. And you know, my heart is racing. I said, okay, are you your heart? She said, no. And we just kept going through all the things that she was present to in her experience until she started laughing. That took 2 minutes. Now, she's a really high performer, so she could get to a place in 2 minutes where she was no longer present to anxiety in that moment because she was in the experience of it rather than conceptualizing, oh, I have anxiety. Now, what do I do? So forget about trying to fix it. Forget about trying to solve a problem because you've created a problem and then you're looking for a solution. And when you don't find a solution, you're then resigned to this is the way it's always going to be. Instead, question the reality of what you're taking for granted. And the more you can start to question what you're taking for granted, the more the experience of what mental health looks like will alter for many, many people. And I don't know what it looks like in the US, but I do know what it looks like more and more in the UK. And there is a massive shift when we come to thinking about mental health. And it is that mental health is for everyone. It is just part of the experience of being a human being. Just as you have physical health, you have mental health, right? Mm-hmm. There's a company called Sanctus who have built like the first sort of mental health gym. And they've been a real pillar in society in the UK for doing that. And you know, this is something which is just clear as day. Like if you have a mind, a brain, or whatever you want to call it, there's going to be this experience where your health in that department is going to fluctuate moment to moment, day to day. And the more we destigmatize that, the more there's an opportunity to actually move forward. And I think that's what this case for optimism.
Well, that was really expertly said, and your clients are lucky to have you, man.
So, you know, Jay, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. And I want to see, first of all, are there any final things you'd like to share inside of this conversation, or just want to share it with the world?
Well, there's one thing I say whenever I speak, or whenever I'm interviewed, whenever I talk anywhere. And that is, look, I have been at a place that I want to make sure that nobody else has to go to. And that was a place so low that I twice attempted to take my own life. And what I learned from living through those moments is, number one, after that, people come out of the woodwork, they're mad at you. How dare you not just call me, like talk to me. So that's number one. There are people in your life. If you're feeling that right now, there are people in your life who want to listen. I guarantee you. But I always say this. If you truly believe that there's nobody in your life who wants to hear you, who will be there for you, reach out. Talk to me. I promise you I will be there. I've even created a little a buzzword or a little a password that people can say if they don't actually want to say, because saying I need help or I'm struggling is very hard. You can say to me, hey, I heard you on, obviously you heard me talking to Sam here, and I have a question, or would you mind if I ask about something? All you got to do. Don't have to say I'm struggling. You don't have to say I need help. Just say, hey, I have a question. I've had people reach out to me on every social media platform you can imagine. I had someone reach out to me on TikTok. I wouldn't recommend it. I forget I have a TikTok all the time. Don't do that. But if that's the only way you feel comfortable, fine. I'll get back to you as soon as I remember I have a TikTok. Just tell me you have a question and I'll be there. And the reason I say that is that those of us who do this work, we have a saying. And that is, we'd rather spend 2 hours listening to you today than 2 hours at your funeral tomorrow. So please reach out.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful and powerful way to leave this. And, you know, finally, like, I'll make sure in the show notes there's all the ways to contact Jay. But just, Jay, like, what is the best way to get people to get in touch with you?
Yep. Well, there's a contact me page on my website, which is jayshiffman.com, jayshiffman.com. You can also find me on every social media. I'm either Jay Shiffman or Choose Your Struggle. And every Choose Your Struggle podcast is wherever you're listening to this. It's there. And you know, I am easy to find. There aren't a lot of Jay Shiffmans out there. I hold the trademark on Choose Your Struggle, so not a lot of those either. So please, I sincerely mean that. Please reach out.
Well, it's been a really fantastic conversation, and it's been a pleasure to have you on, Jay. Thank you.
Yes, Sam, thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Thank you for taking the time to listen. Your support really means the world to me. And without it, this podcast wouldn't exist. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. And please share your biggest takeaways or what you want to hear discussed going forward by going to thishumanlife.com. And if you're ready to be in the driver's seat of your life, then go to cpl.thephilosophicalcoach.com.